Hi, David. Jeffrey Wells speaking. Are you okay to talk?
How are you? Yes, I am. How are you, sir?
I'm quite well. It was a very, very nice event last night.
I must say, a lot of people I haven't seen for a while, and a lot of lovely memories.
I was good to see the hale and hearty Bruce Dern there. He
he's a pal, and I hear Nebraska's terrific. I'm going to see it at the New York Film Festival, but there's a lot of nice buzz about it.
You've been a regular, you've been a New Yorker pretty much all your life. You never really lived out here, right? You've always lived in New York, right?
No, I lived out here twice, once for 3 years and once for 7 years.
Okay. Was that during the Paramount period when you lived out? What period?
Your point is correct. Your point is correct. I am a New Yorker.
Okay. All right. You know, I'm there's a passion that I feel for Bruce. He's one of the great raconteurs, one of the greatest raconteurs I've ever spoken to. He has the greatest stories. They're equal to your experience and stories in your book. He's really wonderful. I mean, you know that better than I. So you know,
and he's a major asset on a movie because he just contributes such a special quality. He's gets involved. He's terrific.
Yeah. I'm going to throw you a hypothetical before we talk about the book, because you've dealt with gifted and genius level filmmakers. You've dealt with filmmakers that you consider to be not necessarily genius, like Stanley Kramer. You really know your stuff. So there's a thing going on that I think it sounds tragic to me, but I just wanted to get you to give me a gut reaction. If you were running Paramount,
you say it says it sounds what to you, tragic?
Yes, I'm about to tell you what I feel is a sad, tragic thing happening with
a Martin. I wanted to make sure I got the word right. Sorry. Okay.
Martin Scorsese's film called Wolf of Wall Street. It's about hubris and arrogance and on Wall Street, and it's basically very much like Goodfellas, and it's a lot like Casino. It's kind of you could almost call it the end of a trilogy of his sort of American hustler movies about a guy who has a great meteoric rise, very giddy and euphoric, and then he hits the wall, the law comes after him, things go badly, and he goes down. It's basically the same tale. And they were going to release it in November. And Scorsese, who's a very exacting, very, very, you know, brilliant man, he can't get it to a length that they want. And what everybody's saying is that they may bump it.
He can't get it to what?
To the proper length that Paramount wants. They want something shorter.
The final cut. Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
It's something like, allegedly, it's in the 3-hour range. And my first thought was, you know, Scorsese is such a great filmmaker, it's like a great bath to be able to take a 3-hour movie with him. I would love to do that. And apparently there's some mindset going on right now. Maybe, obviously, you've been through enough of a history, but what happened to the idea of 3 hours being interesting? I know that that's, obviously, exhibitors hate that. They prefer all movies to be 85 minutes long or shorter, but still, there's a certain validity to a long movie that needs 3 hours to tell it. What was your feeling about that in your...
You're generalizing, Jeffrey. I mean, the problem is that every movie is different, right?
Yeah.
And some movies are perfect at 90 minutes or 88 minutes,
right,
and some movies are perfect at 3.5 hours. And the question is, who's going to make the final decision? You know, the vast majority of movies that are financed today, the financiers have that control, unless the filmmaker is of such stature that they have given him final cut. And then it comes down to relationship, negotiation, testing, and you can't generalize because every single picture is different.
Yeah.
And without having seen the picture, there's no way I could, or anybody could, say the studio's right, Mr. Scorsese is right. You know, filmmakers feel very protective of the movies they make, and often, you know, feel that a bit more is better. The studios quite often think that less is more. But you know, without seeing the movie and without knowing the content or anything, you know, all you can say is that whatever comes out, I hope it's the best version it can be. But there's no way to know who's between them, who is appropriate. I mean, it's because first of all, the studio is not the studio. It's an individual or two. And it depends on who those individuals or two are.
Mm.
In the case of UA, from, you know, when I was in a position of authority, it was me.
Yeah.
At Focus, it's James Chambers. But I don't know whose film it is. I don't know the content of the film. And, you know, it winds up being a negotiation between a very strong-willed, extremely talented filmmaker and a company that's put a lot of money up for the film and for the marketing of the film.
Yeah.
And hopefully, between them, they'll agree on what is the best version of the movie. But it's impossible for an outsider to intelligently have an opinion about which one is right. You know, it just doesn't work. I mean, there are some filmmakers who are notorious.
Yeah.
For, you know,
going long, you mean?
Yeah, padding content.
Yeah.
There are other filmmakers, you know, who make movies that are 85 minutes.
Yeah.
So, and you know, Sidney Lumet was brilliant. I mean, his movies, there wasn't a wasted second in a film. Mm. But everybody's got a different style. So all I would say is that I just hope it's the best picture it could be, whatever it is. But I wouldn't know how any outsider could have a comment that would be worth paying any attention to.
Yeah, okay. I just happened to read Terrence Winter's script, and it's clearly the same tone. It's the same movie as Goodfellas. Goodfellas was brilliant. I could watch that movie another 10, 20 times.
Absolutely.
You know. But the...
knowing Scorsese,
yeah,
who I don't know personally, but knowing the kind of filmmaker he is,
yeah,
you know, I mean, you want an abstract opinion, I'd always lean on Scorsese.
Mm.
But again, you don't know the situation, and it's really an impossible thing to judge,
right,
without knowing the content and without knowing what the disagreement is.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed your story, particularly of Stanley Kramer insisting to you guys when he first showed you his initial director's cut of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, that it was 4 hours and 1 minute, and he says, I'm going to tell you this before we even sit down, I cannot cut a single frame of it. I love that you guys stood up and said, well, sorry, you're going to cut some.
But the bottom line is you never cut enough. I mean, we finally just, you know... I mean, short of taking the movie over, which we didn't want to do, got it down to where it was, but it should have been another 15, 20 minutes shorter.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, the shorter it got, the better it got. It's really interesting. But Stanley was a very passionate, very single-minded, you know, autocratic filmmaker, and he wanted it his way. And, you know, by contract, because he was so far over budget, we did have the right to take over the film.
Right.
But, you know, we would never do that, or not unless we were actually forced to the wall.
Mm.
But, you know, you just did we did the best we could with him, and finally let it go at the length he was prepared to finally get it down to.
Yeah. There was a fascinating story that you told about Robert Altman. You guys did not get along that well. You had your disagreements. He was not the most... agreeable fellow in your experience anyway, and you mentioned that he has nonetheless. I mean, you wouldn't begrudge him. He has made some very good films. I thought it was interesting that you listed a few of them, a few of the more obvious choices, Shortcuts and McCabe and Mrs. Miller and MASH, of course. But you did not mention The Player. I take it you didn't care for that film.
I don't even remember it, to be honest with you.
Okay. Anyway, I thought it was wonderful.
It wasn't an oversight. It just never occurred to me.
Yeah, yeah, okay. There was a...
You get to be a certain age, and you've seen so many thousands of movies every now and then.
Right.
Something gets by. But in that case, I actually don't remember the movie.
Yeah. How long did it take you, and when did the inception, the idea for doing this book? I'm sure people have been telling you for years to write something. Why did you finally write something? What was the trigger that got you going on it, and how long did it take?
Well, I don't think it was a specific trigger. Yes, you're absolutely right. As I mentioned, people have been telling me that, you know, you got to write these stories down. People will enjoy reading them.
Yeah.
And I finally decided that I had the time to do it, and I sat down. It took two and a half years.
Wow, that's a...
I write longhand. I cannot write on a computer because I can't type fast enough to keep up with my thoughts.
Yeah.
And since college, I've written better studied better writing longhand, and so I wrote it longhand.
You know, that's fascinating. You can actually, I was just telling a friend that I found an essay that I wrote when I was in the fifth or sixth grade, maybe 11 or 12 years old. My handwriting was pretty good. You're very legible and very exacting. I cannot write to save my life now. It's like I've lost the ability or the discipline to write even half legibly. I take it that you're, I mean, I find it fascinating that you say you can write faster than you can type. That's amazing.
Well, it isn't about speed. It's not about time.
Yeah.
When I write, because I write longhand on a lined pad.
Mm.
It is like I'm able to put my thoughts on paper more clearly,
right,
because I'm writing it and it's coming out of my body onto the piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
There's a connection to what I'm writing that I just, because I don't type fast, I mean, I'd have to hunt and peck. I go crazy because my mind would be, I'd be looking for why and my mind would be three sentences ahead. So there was not even an issue there. Ever since I went to school, in my high school and college days, I've always written and studied writing longhand.
Ah. Well, it's a very, very clean and very agreeable and very readable. I mean, it's a very good read. I mean, I got to hand it to you. There's an art. We all know that. I know it, certainly, being a writer. But there's an art to not overwriting, to not making your sentences overly dense. There's a certain pitch that when writing comes out well, as it does with your book, it's really, really a pleasure. I really enjoy it.
I appreciate that. You know, it's interesting. Obviously, over the years, family and friends have heard the stories. And, you know, let's face it, you know, I'm in the business of telling stories. That's what movies do. We tell stories.
Yeah.
And you know, when you write at least this kind of stuff, you're telling a story. So what I basically did was take the stories that I've been telling to my friends and family over these years, and I wrote them down.
Right.
And the interesting response is like yours. It sounds as if you're telling me a story. Well, it sounds as if I am, because that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, it has worked, it gives me enormous pleasure. I must say, I've never done this before. My chances of doing it again are probably slim.
Right.
Unless there's something, maybe some fiction I might try to write. But,
but
the pleasure that I'm getting is that people are enjoying it for its content,
right,
for its style of writing or anything like that. But because they get a look at the inside of an industry that I love,
yeah,
people that I love, and even the ones I hate, I have fun writing about. And they think it's from a perspective, it's one of reasonableness. It's not like I have an axe to grind or a point to prove. I'm simply sharing the enormous pleasure that I've had in these decades with people and hoping they enjoy it, and obviously they seem to.
Right. I'm going to ask you something about Lenny, which I happened to see for the very, very first time, and we're talking about a long time ago, but it's not out, you might know, it's not out on, at least not on Blu-ray, and I don't think, it might be out on DVD, but I haven't seen it in quite a long time.
Yeah, it's out on DVD. It fell between the cracks when UA was acquired by MGM, and so if you can get it, you can get it online easier than you can get it on, you know, any other way. But it's there are copies for sale. But it's a movie I'm very proud of. It was actually the first movie I actually produced, so it was very special to me.
I remember it's really got the distinctive close-up, introspective, very intimate, very probing Bob Fosse style to it. But I remember that something that Pauline Kael wrote way back when, and she said that Lenny Bruce was not what you would call an endearing fellow. He was kind of had a cruelty about him, but he had a bluntness, you know, sharpness about him also, which is when he got going on that, in that vein, he was really, that was where his genius was from. And I found myself suddenly recalling what she felt, because after seeing, this is, you know, I just saw it about 4 months ago, Valerie Perrine showed up at the Aero Theater to do a little Q&A afterwards. And the surprising thing is that Dustin Hoffman tries way too hard to be lovable. He's smiling all the time. And I realized that she was right, you know, that he Fosse just let him, you know, try and win the audience over. And, you know, you kind of liked him because he was doing a lot of chuckling and there's a twinkle in his eye and he was kind of, it just wasn't Lenny Bruce.
Well, you may say that, but if you went back and looked at the stuff that we did, you found stuff that had the essence of what Dustin was trying to do. Mm. I mean, the major vision people had of Lenny Bruce is obviously the earth-shaking anger and cynicism and humor and sardonic wit, right, that he portrayed. Mm. But you research and you talk to the people who knew him, right, and worked with him, and he was much more complex than that. Mm. And Dustin, you know, between Bob Fosse and Dustin Hoffman, I'm more than satisfied to say that the interpretation that they brought to it is one that I think was extremely, extremely astute and adroit and remarkable in many ways.
Yeah, I love that tale you told about Hoffman preparing himself for a scene in which he was pretty wrecked and depleted, and he came out in socks and a raincoat and just didn't have anything left, but he was so spent by his battles over the court prosecutions. And you said that he had actually kept himself up for, what, 3 days, no
Correct.
Sleep?
He didn't go to sleep for 3.5-4 yeah. days.
That's a great, I mean, that's...
Well, that's what actors do. That's what great actors do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, great actors are not great by accident.
Yeah.
There's a reason beyond their talent and beyond their commitment. They have that something that makes them great. And Dustin's interpretation of that role and his commitment to appearing the way he felt Lenny actually felt at that point in time involved obviously not taking cocaine, because that wouldn't have been very positive, but not going to sleep for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, who would have even thought of that? Mm. I mean, we didn't think of it. We didn't even know he was doing it until he showed up. And that's a kind of commitment to craft that those of us who support this work have to recognize and why we care about so much about what we do.
Mm. I know that at the very time you were producing Lenny, which came out in 1974, you were simultaneously exec producing a film that, in my view, is far and away the best disaster film of that disaster film cycle.
Juggernaut? Yeah, it's right up there with my favorite films.
Yeah.
I actually was commuting from Miami Beach to London. There were nonstop flights on what an airline that doesn't exist anymore, National Airlines. Huh. And for 3 or 4 months in a row, I was commuting, making a trip back and forth every week from London to Miami.
So almost all of Lenny was shot in Miami, you're telling me?
Sorry, again?
Okay.
What did you say about Miami?
Are you saying that almost all of Lenny was shot in Miami, in that area?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
You want to know why?
Yes.
Can you guess?
Because the
reason we were able to do it is that we had a budget within which we had to work, and we could hire extras in Miami for $25 a day in that time, and to do it in New York or Los Angeles, it would have been triple to quadruple that.
Oh, okay.
And so we were able to, and just to give you an idea of the kind of thought you go through when you're hiring extras to be filmed watching a comic perform, you want them to laugh appropriately, not laugh. They can't act laugh because they're not actors.
Mm.
Even actors, but faking laughing is hard to do.
Mm.
So, okay, now you're going to get them to laugh.
Right.
Well, in movies, you obviously have to do more than one take on every scene, right?
Yeah.
And what happens if you've got a bunch of people listening to a comic routine that you want them to be laughing to, and you do it once and maybe twice, by the third time they've heard it, they know what's coming. They're not going to respond anymore. So we had to have enough extras so that when we did multiple takes, we could get 50 or 100 people out of the room and pick 50 or 100 more back in.
Mm.
So that's the kind of attention to detail that directors and producers who care about what they're doing,
right,
and you know, want it to be the best it could be. That's the kind of attention to detail you have to do.
Now, the just for those who weren't around during the early 70s, but there was a genre called the disaster movie genre, earthquake and Poseidon Adventure. So when people heard about a film called Juggernaut, which is another disaster film about a bomb in a boat, it was a great surprise to see something that was as well written in terms of character driven, and very exacting and close and very specific as far as the leads. Just
it's a very good movie, and yeah. It wasn't treated very well by UA. They really didn't know what they had. It got a kind of cursory release, which I thought was very disappointing.
Mm.
It's very interesting. Of all the films I've done, Juggernaut is right up there with the people's response. The cinephiles really like that movie, and there's a reason for it. It's a very, very, very well-made movie.
Yeah,
it's very well directed, and I don't have time to go into the details.
Yeah.
The book, I think I mentioned them. It was very well produced.
That little bit where the kids are looking over the flags of what various flags mean when the ship raises them, and then that. Brilliant little touches like that, where the little kids, oh, that means we're carrying explosives, and every single little bit.
Dick Lester's a fabulous director.
Now, there must have been a general impetus, though, on your part and others that, well, we're going to make a disaster film, let's just do another one, you know. Why did you guys decide to go the high end, the sophisticated, intelligent end, when everybody knew these movies don't require sophistication and character driving?
Well, first of all,
you know.
Well, in those days, there weren't many of those movies, and secondly, all due respect, I mean, as a producer and a director, you make the movie you want to make. I don't even begin to think of, I mean, friends of mine have made disaster movies, they're pretty damn good.
Yeah.
We made Juggernaut, I'm very proud of it. It's a terrific movie, actually. I appreciate your liking it a lot. And it was a very, very, very interesting and happy experience making that movie.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier
I'm proud of it.
Yeah, I think you should be proud. It's really one of my... I could watch that movie repeatedly. I would love to see that a good version of it on Blu-ray someday. Are you a big Blu-ray aficionado, or how do you watch your...
I am not, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I rarely watch them on TV, to be honest with you. I mean, I'll watch a movie if it's on TV, but I can't remember. And in Oscar time, I'll look at some of the Oscar movies that the studios send.
Mm.
But I don't normally...
There's a wonderful new channel that Walmart, of all people, have called Vudu, V-U-D-U. And a lot of the older films are rendered in high definition on this channel. And if you have a strong enough Wi-Fi connection in your home, things look pretty damn good. It's really pretty impressive to be able to see older films look as sharp, like they just came out of the lab, you know, that really wonderful quality, you know.
That's great. It's good to hear.
Yeah,
we live in a big Manhattan complex apartment, so we get what we get.
Yeah. Well, I just always want to take my hat off to anybody who had anything.
I certainly appreciate your love of film. You're clearly an aficionado, that's really nice to hear.
I'm very sorry for. I always felt personally badly for poor George Stevens, whose work I've admired all the way going back to the days of Gunga Din up until. Anne Frank, I think, was kind of the end of his great cycle. You must have developed an opinion over the years that most filmmakers, sooner or later, now the rare ones like Scorsese, thank goodness, don't, but they all succumb sooner or later to a certain hardening of the creative arteries, if you will. I think that Alfred Hitchcock started to succumb to that somewhere around Marnie or you know, that area. His stuff just didn't have that snappy spring to it.
Well, I mean, that's just life. I mean, all of us, you know, have periods of our life that we grow, we develop,
yeah.
We expand,
yeah.
We get older, things change. I mean, nobody is the same all the way through 15, 20, 30, 40 years in filmmaking. That's not possible.
Yeah.
You know, but what you do is you recognize, depending upon your level of interest, and you're obviously someone who cares a lot.
Yeah.
You recognize those moments that are special to them, and you justify or understand the rest because time moves on.
Yeah.
I'm sure in your own life, I don't know how old you are or what you've done, but you know, as you mature as you get older. Your tastes change, your levels of commitment change, your attention to detail changes. I mean, that's only the human factor.
Yeah.
And you look at the great filmmakers, and you'll see great films, and then you'll see films that, you know, maybe ain't so great. But
yeah.
I mean, how you know, I'd be thrilled if somebody named one movie that they thought I made was great. I mean, it's and the great thing about it is the movies are there. That's the point of my book.
Mm.
There is no end. Once they're done, they're there and they're available.
Yeah.
And, you know, how many people go into a business, no matter how much they love it,
right.
You know, if it's not of the arts, where there it is.
Mm-hmm.
Architect, sure.
Right.
Painters, absolutely.
Yeah.
Recording artists, sure. But, you know, it's what a privilege to be part of something where what you're part of creating or contributing to lasts forever.
Yeah. I was, but you were, weren't you presiding over, was it Lorimar when SOB was made? The Blake Edwards?
Lorimar. Which film?
SOB, the Blake Edwards film?
Yes, I think I was.
But you were not.
Happy experience.
Okay. Because I always, I very much respected that film. I thought that Blake Edwards did something exceptional by drawing upon.
Well, he was a talented man. He was difficult, but very talented.
Yeah. You mean he was exacting and took longer, and the movies cost more, and he was not as
it was a whole combination of things.
Yeah.
He's a very, very, very big ego to deal with.
Right.
But he certainly was a very talented man.
You know, a lot of people in your realm, the exec producer, studio chief realm, a lot of these guys don't read, but I respected that way back when you were a person who actually read the Bond novels before they got going, and you actually knew what they were. Most people...
Yeah, but you can't generalize. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that, you know, major studio people who are making decisions don't actually read what they're involved in. Maybe they don't. I wouldn't even begin to comment on that.
Yeah.
The fact is that I did what I felt was necessary to make a value judgment.
Right. Well, anyway, I thought it was... It really does. I mean, talk about looking at the older Bond films. I swear to God, there's something really special about those first two that I think because they're lean and they're more, you know, muscular, and they're not as technology driven as they began.
They were new. I mean, they were new. They literally were an attempt to do something slightly different.
Yeah.
And then once it succeeds, that's when it starts to start to feed on itself.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
all right, man. You got to go. I appreciate your time very much. Thank you. We could go on forever, but I love your book, and I'll write something else about it today, and I'll put this up.
I appreciate it. I thank you for your interest, and don't hesitate to get in touch if I could be of any help.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it very much.
Okay. All right. Take care.
Take care.